As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com. Code PROGRAM.
Hello and welcome to the Game Podcast from The Times. I'm Natalie Sawyer.
And I'm Gabriel Marcotti, and we thank you for joining us on this glorious Thursday afternoon. Now, with us in the studio, Natalie, I know you're excited because I am.
Always.
It's Mr. William David Edgar. And for those who don't know by now, he is The Times' chief stats officer. And down the line from the lovely hamlet of Rippenden, it's Ollie Kay. Later on, we'll be anticipating Antoine Griezmann's next move and the knock-on effect it could have on the rest of the transfer market, plus the championship playoff semi-finals.
But we start by looking ahead to this Saturday and the FA Cup final, Manchester City versus Watford. The Hornets hoping to secure the first major silverware in their history, City aiming to become the first team ever to complete the domestic treble. Ollie, we've seen some dominant teams through the years in English football, so are you surprised that no team has ever achieved the feat of the domestic treble?
I suppose when you think about how long English football has been going on, in some ways, yes, because there have been very, very dominant teams in that time, not least sort of, well, in the League Cup era, at least, there's been dominance from Liverpool, dominance from Manchester United. But if you go back to when, I think we're all similar age, when we were growing up, even to win the double was very rare. Obviously, Spurs had done it in 61 and Arsenal in 71, then Liverpool did it in 86. But in those, it's five times in the first 100 years of league football. And then there was just this spate of them with Manchester United and Arsenal again and again. And then Chelsea in 2010, wasn't it? And so I guess as the big clubs have become more dominant, maybe you would expect it more. And I guess you don't get many teams coming along like this Manchester City team. So it does make sense that it's quite a rare thing, although not many of the big clubs in recent years have taken the League Cup quite as seriously and sort of single-mindedly as Manchester City have.
We have come close, though, haven't we, Bill, in past times of teams trying to get the treble being, let's just remind everybody what that is, it's the League Cup and the FA Cup.
Yes, there have been other trebles which have included a European trophy, but never the domestic treble.
There have been silly trebles too, right? Silly. Like the one Mourinho won?
Europa
League?
Yeah, the Community Shield. You can immediately discard all mention of that. The League and the FA Cup have been running since the 19th century. The League Cup started in 1960, and by the mid-60s, more or less everybody was taking part. So realistically, there have been 55 years to do the treble. In that time, there have been 20 domestic doubles, but probably the two closest of those cases to a treble were Manchester United in 1994, when they won the League and FA Cup double, and they lost the League Cup final to Aston Villa. And then in 2007, when Chelsea won both domestic cups and were second in the league to Manchester United. So I guess it's perhaps not surprising that teams haven't done the treble. And Ollie says clubs haven't taken the League Cup that seriously, at many stages of its existence, especially in the last 20 years. And also, even if you perform the best in all three competitions, the randomness of football just means you know it's so easy just to be unlucky to miss out on. You need luck as well, or you need to be so superior to every other team that even when you run into a bit of bad luck, that's still you can overcome that. And you could argue, you could put Manchester City into that category. They are, to my mind, they're the best team I've ever seen anyway. So I guess they're the one team who you might expect could come close to it.
Oh, should we make Ollie uncomfortable by asking him if Manchester City are the best English club side he's ever seen?
I would say you could make a very, very strong argument that the quality of the football is the best we've seen in English football. And because if you look at where the players come from and in the Premier League, there aren't sort of journeyman, non-international footballers like there would have been in great Liverpool teams and Manchester United teams and Arsenal teams of the 20th century. So I think there's a very, very strong argument. The argument against them is that they haven't done it in Europe yet. And, okay, it came down to a fractional VAR decision in the game against Tottenham in the quarterfinal. But if you look at the past three seasons, yes, there's randomness, yes, there's luck in the Champions League, but if you look at the past three seasons, they've fallen short in Europe and they've not performed as brilliantly in Europe as they have on the domestic front. But I would say in terms of just the sheer quality from 1 to 11, the sheer quality of the football, and in terms of dominance, I probably would agree with what Bill says.
We mentioned it before about how the Premier League is more polarised and the bigger clubs have many times the resources of the lesser clubs. So they are a whole heck of a lot better. But by the same token, I mean, clubs that are finishing 13th, 14th, 15th in the table today, they would probably wipe the floor with clubs that finished 13th, 14th, and 15th 20 years ago, yeah, let alone 30 or 40 years ago. So those guys have actually gotten a lot better too.
Yeah, right? I mean, you have to kind of almost allow for inflation, as it were. You kind of accept that the football, that every team is so much better than 30 or 40 years ago. Obviously, the conditioning of the players and the pitches are
infinitely for places.
Yeah.
The professionalism.
Yeah.
You know,
everything. It's so much better. So, I mean, in one way, you could say, well, the current 20 teams are the best 20 ever. But, I mean, I suppose you have to kind of count whatever the average standard is now in the Premier League and say, where are Manchester City compared with that? And I just think they're so much better than the average that I would have them as the very best. I mean, it's and I'd put almost all down to Guardiola, I have to say. Think of back to the early days of this decade, and City did win the league under Mancini and Pellegrini, and David Silva was a really, you know, such a key player, so much better creatively than the rest of the team. It was there's a really strong case for man marking him. But now, you wouldn't man mark anyone at Manchester City. They're all good, all 11, just pass all equally, well, not equally, but more or less equally good at passing it around, passing and moving, joining in this incredible fast-paced attacking, that it would be futile just to mark one. And I think it's just the coaching is just extraordinary.
What about Watford then? How much of a chance do we give them, Gab?
I think they maybe have a better chance than some people would realize. First of all, City in one-off games, and this might just be an absolute quirk this year, but City came within, 10 minutes of getting knocked out of this competition by Swansea, right? They were 2-0 down with 20 minutes to go in, I think it was a quarterfinal. Now, I realize that wasn't a priority for them or whatever else, but they still had to, you know, chuck on all the big guns, and Aguero scored 2 minutes from time. Then when they played Brighton in the semifinal, and this was a Brighton team that clearly had prioritized, remember he played that weird lineup Chris Hughton did? They were obviously prioritizing staying up, and they won 1-0. I'm not saying they didn't create other chances, so there's a lot of things that can go wrong. This is the nature of a low-scoring sport. Now, add to that that on paper, at least, I've said this before, I think Watford have one of the top two or three central midfields in the Premier League, in Doucouré and Kapoue, who I think are ideally placed to be disruptive should Watford, you know, elect to go and sit. I'm not saying they'll definitely do it because it's very difficult to do because City are that good, but if the game does get physical, Watford think of a definite edge. Watford can play a front true if they so choose in Deeney and Gray, or they may play Deeney plus De La Feu. Either way, Deeney is a big physical guy, and if he doesn't do silly things like get himself sent off early like he did against, was it that Monday night game against Arsenal?
Yeah.
You know, he's unpleasant to play against. So there's a lot of little things, I think, that you can... There's a lot of little edges that Watford have, and... You know, they also need good fortune, which you always need. But, you know, we have seen City late in the season. I'll make another analogy. And look, I think player for player, Leicester are a much better team, right? But we saw on Monday night, not that long ago, City with everything to play for going to face Leicester with nothing to play for, and City needing an incredible low percentage, long range effort from Vincent Kompany to score. And ultimately, that was a goal that effectively gave them the title. So put these factors in there. I think we are going to see a game, and I think this could be very close.
Javi Gracia, he wasn't even nominated for Manager of the Year, but it would be an amazing achievement. Bear in mind the season they've had as well, which has been pretty decent.
Yeah, I mean, he has a history of getting smaller clubs to punch way above their weight. Going back to Malaga, think of all the mean things certain people, Ollie Kay, said about Watford and the way they were run and the Pozzo family and how no manager lasts more than a season. Well, you know, he's managed to prove them wrong. I think some people, I honestly don't know about you, Bill. I do know about you, Ollie, so we'll leave that to one side, predicted that Watford were going to go down at the start of the season. Were you one of them?
No, I didn't at all, actually. But
okay, so
not
just...
saying I get all my predictions right, but I didn't. But he's yeah, he's been a year and a half, and he's already been there longer than the last seven managers. He only has to last to the start of next season, and he's longer than the last nine. So.
Troy Deeney has been there for nine seasons, and he has worked under 11 different managers, which is pretty awesome.
Wow.
Yeah.
That is.
Were you going to suggest that I tipped Watford to go down, Gab?
I believe you did.
I'm just
and you had Javi Gracia as the first manager to be sacked, because somebody on Watford Twitter... made me aware of this.
Somebody on Watford Twitter made me aware of it. I'm just looking at who did I predict? Oh, right, Cardiff, Fulham, Huddersfield. Oh, I see. All three correct. Everybody else did.
Who's your first manager to be sacked?
Puel.
Oh, really? I must have you mistaken with Henry Winter. You sound the same to me.
Very, very easily done. Very easily done. No, my predictions for once were excellent. Because
oh, wow. Well done.
Because I didn't put any money on them. So
right.
It's, but no, look, on Javi Gracia, I think you could have made the case for him to be the sort of making up the numbers candidate on the Manager of the Year shortlist. I don't think anybody would put his body of work this season next to, say, Guardiola's or Klopp's, but he has done very well with a mid-table team. 11th, did they finish? It's not brilliant, yeah. but their cup run has been really good. And it's interesting to me because the view at Watford for a long time has been managers have a 2-year shelf life. Well, he's sort of 18 months in, and he's doing really well. And I would think that they are looking to take him into his third season, although his second anniversary wouldn't be till midway through last season. I would think he's done more than enough to justify being the exception to that rule.
I think it's also the case, if you're a club in Watford's position, and I know when people go and, you know, talk about the 11 managers or whatever that Watford have had, it's not because they have an insane owner who's trigger happy. It's because managers have left for different reasons. You know, one of them, Marco Silva, transformed himself into a snake and slithered off to Goodison. You know, Oscar had like a serious, you know, he had a serious physical problem. Others, Sanino resigned. Billy McKinley was there for two games because he was filling in. You know, people seem to forget this stuff, right? But generally for clubs at that level, you know, if the manager does well, somebody's going to come and get him. Somebody bigger and better resourced. And if the manager does badly, there's so much competition to avoid going down that you're likely to let him go.
It seems like if a manager, by his third year, if they're not sort of still improving, if they're not treading water, then there's a clamour for change, isn't there? So, but whether it's from the fans or the media or from the board, it feels like you can't just have a sort of steady sort of 5 or 6 years at a club anymore. You've got to be progressing, and I think the Watford model probably feels a lot more natural in 2019 than it did when there was that sort of heavy turnover of managers in the early years. I mean, even when they got rid of Sanchez Flores after a good first season to most people's minds, I think people were shocked by it, but I think people probably accept the logic of it now and probably see the same with Chris Hughton, say, where it was a good first half of the season and then a difficult second half of the season. And you know, I think people can understand the sort of Pozzo way of looking at these things now. And the encouraging thing for Javi Gracia is that despite a slight dip towards the end of the season, it all looks like it's still moving forward.
So obviously the FA Cup final is to come this weekend. This month there are plenty of other cup finals. Let's discuss the Europa League final, in particular with regards to actually the fact that Chelsea may well be missing Ruben Loftus-Cheek after he suffered an ankle injury playing for the club in a friendly against New England Revolution in America. The friendly did raise $4 million for organisations that combat hate crime, but as I say, it has come at a cost for Ruben Loftus-Cheek. How do we feel about this situation? Ollie, let me ask you first.
Well, it's never a good look when a player gets injured in a friendly, especially an end-of-season friendly before a cup final. But I've seen Chelsea getting slaughtered for this, but is it not reasonable, really, to have an end-of-season friendly, particularly if you've got a final on the horizon? I mean, obviously, this was arranged in advance, but if I don't imagine Sarri or Emery or any of the managers with European finals on the go on the horizon would be thinking it's ideal to have sort of 2 or 3 weeks without a match. I think it's not a bad thing really to be playing an end of season friendly. The issue of travel of you know conditioning etc. I mean who knows how whether there were any deviations from their normal sort of pre-match build-up or whatever, but I don't think playing an end-of-season friendly match is something that's normally guaranteed to result in an injury. So I think some of the criticism of Chelsea is a bit harsh in that respect.
I think also the fact that it's not like they flew to Abu Dhabi to ponce around in front of a bunch of sheikhs and trouser $10 million. You know, they went somewhere to raise a lot of money for a very good cause to combat hate crimes. And I think it's also relevant, you know, within the context of a club who has a fan base, where part of their fan base has a history of whether it's extremist politics and anti-Semitism and possibly, you know, we're talking about a small minority, but, you know, it is historically a vocal minority and has been part of the perception, anti-Semitism as well, when it comes to Spurs, although it's a more complex discussion, the Raheem Sterling incident. So, yeah, I mean, who's to say Ruben Loftus-Cheek wouldn't have hurt his ankle in training, you know? Obviously, they could have done without flying 6 hours to Boston and back. I think that's pretty clear.
But I suppose they do fly first class. They're well looked after on a flight. It's not as bad as some would have to go through.
I don't think they do fly first class. I think they fly business class.
Business these days not so bad, though, is it?
Well, you know what? The problem with a six-hour flight, though, is that unless you're really good at falling asleep, even with one of those flatbeds, as you know, Natalie, you can't, you know, you don't get a good night's sleep, basically.
This is true. No, I understand. This is true. Bill, what do you think? Do you have an opinion on it?
Yeah, I guess. But the fact that it was only 3 days after the last game of the season, perhaps that's not ideal. That you wouldn't want to have no games at all for 2.5 weeks to the final. So ideally, it could have been scheduled a bit later, but I mean, it's just bad luck. I mean, you're always going to get the odd injury, as Gab says, in training there'll be something going on. It's just a shame it's Loftus-Cheek who's bang in form at the moment, and arguably should be in the England 11 at the Nations League if fit.
The train is now approaching. Junction at platform. Passengers, by port, please stay on board. Next stop, Road Station.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Every Thursday at thetimes.co.uk, our very own Bill Edgar provides 11 trivia teasers for you. And here is one for you on this very podcast. Last weekend, which team became the first for 14 years to receive less than one yellow card per game over a Premier League season? Yeah. Who's been good?
Well, the process of elimination, I'm assuming it's not Burnley, and it's probably not Manchester United. I'm thinking of one of the slightly more effete teams, but also probably a team with an Anglo manager who everybody loves. I'm looking at you, Eddie Howe.
Interesting.
It's funny. Okay, I'm not having a pop at Bournemouth, but you know, a guy who works for a Premier League club, which may or may not be south of Birmingham, who is convinced that Eddie Howe has some kind of voodoo going on with the referees, and he trains his players. He feels that they get more favorable calls than anybody else in the Premier League. It's the way they act. It's the way they don't. I mean, they've got some hard players. Obviously, they have Jefferson Lerma, who will, you know, kick you seven ways to Sundays, but they generally don't have guys who argue. They don't have guys who annoy referees. They don't have guys who take dives. And they're really good at influencing referees. So he's got this whole bee in his bonnet about it. I don't know if it's true.
They've got an incredible number of opponents sent off over the last year or so.
Bournemouth, really?
Yeah, I mean, it could be just chance, but yeah, maybe there's something in that.
You should follow up on this, because it is a bit of a dark art, right?
It's a good one. If you want to know the answer to our trivia teaser, then all you have to do is stick around until the end of the podcast to find out the answer. Now, one of the world's most sought-after players announced on Tuesday that he'll be leaving Atletico Madrid this summer. Antoine Griezmann is that man, bringing an end to 5 years in Madrid. Gab, what is his release clause and where might he be going?
I think it's about 120 million. And he's been strongly, strongly linked to Barcelona. He's been partly because he was heavily linked to Barcelona last season, too. If you remember, he made that silly video, which is actually produced by Gerard Piqué's production company. Because, of course, Gerard Piqué is kind of like the LeBron of football, in the sense that, you know, he's got his fingers in many different pies. Or the real Ferdinand, if you will. Barcelona obviously feel like they need a lift, and obviously they're getting a tremendous footballer. Although, dude's 28 years old. Obviously, he makes them better. I think it's going to have implications because he costs a lot of money. I think it's going to mean that they'll probably have to sell Coutinho. And if they want Matthijs de Ligt, who's the other guy they've been linked with, and remember, they've already signed Frankie de Jong from Ajax, they'll probably have to sell more guys like Rakitic, possibly Umtiti, guys like that. So if you're a Rakitic fan out there, Manchester United supporters, what do you think, Bill? You up for that?
Yeah.
Would you have Rakitic? You're 31?
Yeah. Well,
the new Schweinsteiger?
Upgrade on Herrera, yeah.
All right, just wondering.
Well, there's also the likes of Dembele as well, and Coutinho. There's quite a few potential Premier League clubs that might well be interested in the fact that if Barcelona do sign Griezmann, they may well have to sell to balance the books.
Yeah, I don't think they're going to sell Dembele just because he's young, and also he's really quick, which really none of the other guys are anymore at this stage, of their careers.
Of course, if they do bring in Antoine Griezmann, you'd imagine Real Madrid will want to bring in someone of a similar standing. Does this increase, Ollie, the likelihood of Eden Hazard lining up at the Bernabeu next season?
It probably does. I mean, I think the chances of that are already high. I think Chelsea seem to be fully aware of that, and Hazard is certainly fully aware of their interest, which is more than reflected by his interest. The interesting dimension of it is what happens if Chelsea's transfer ban is upheld. Can they possibly sell him and not replace him? Obviously, they've got Pulisic coming in. They've got Hudson-Odoi emerging, but obviously is injured at the moment. But it does sound like Hazard is going. There's been talk about Pogba going to Madrid as well. And again, the player would certainly welcome that. And I think what's still to become clear, really, is whether Manchester United would welcome that. Because I think there'd be I know there's an argument among Manchester United fans about building a team around Pogba. I think there's a argument among other Manchester United fans and other Manchester United watchers about trying to build an exit tunnel for Pogba. So that's an interesting one. Real Madrid will. I mean, if you look how Real Madrid last summer, they lost Ronaldo. They didn't really make a big splash in the transfer market at all. They didn't really sign what you would consider a top grade replacement, and they have what is, in some areas of the team, a lot of their key players are now the wrong side of 30 and will need replacing. It's a team that has sort of grown old, and they've won the Champions League in, what was it, four of the past six seasons. And I think at times that sort of paper over the cracks and has allowed them to not make long-term decisions. I think they've got to make a few long-term decisions. So as well as the sort of Hazard-type signing, I think they've got to be in the market for some outstanding young players as well.
And sticking with transfer news, it's been reported that Wilfred Zaha has told Crystal Palace he wants to leave. He, of course, signed a five-year contract last summer. So will he get his wish, Ollie?
The difficulty is that Palace's valuation is going to be huge. I mean, I remember 2 years ago, Sam Allardyce, when he was manager of Palace, saying, "Oh, if anybody was going to come in and buy Wilf Zaha, they'd have to pay 50 million." Now that was 2 years ago, and you look at not just his progression since then, but the transfer market inflation since then, and it's not surprising that the word coming out of Palace is that he would cost upwards of 100 million. It's not, I don't think anybody could be surprised about
but
that.
But how old is he? Isn't he like 26, 27 now?
No, 26.
He's 26. That's a lot of money.
It is, but he's a proven Premier League player. He doesn't come with any of the risks, perhaps, that Pulisic would come with and other players who are bought from outside of the Premier League. I think when you look at some of the valuations and fees, it's not in the Premier League these days. It's not the craziest one we've ever heard. If Zaha would cost 100 million, you'd get better value, perhaps from doing something a bit more imaginative. But I certainly think from Palace's point of view, they're more than entitled to ask.
I think that the difficulty in pitching him at 100 million is that when you only have one buyer or a small group of buyers, I didn't know this, it's called a monopsony. I knew about what monopoly meant, but monopsony is when there's only one buyer, right? And obviously that means that the price goes down. If you're talking about 100 million for Wilfred Zaha, leave aside whether he's worth it or not. Materially, who can buy him? United, City, Liverpool. And that's it. I mean, Arsenal can't. I mean, and you look at those clubs, and obviously he's already been at United, and could United use him? Of course. And would it be a tremendous story? Yeah, sure. But then there's a million other dudes that United could also buy. I don't think City particularly feel like they necessarily need Wilfred Zaha. And obviously Liverpool, they got pretty decent wingers right now. So it's almost like if you're Zaha and you want to go to a bigger club and you're at Palace and you want to cash in, you got to start thinking in terms of the Everton-Leicester level. Wolves level, and those guys can't play 100 million, and so you have to naturally drop it down, and depending how far you drop down, you might actually say, you know what, it's not worth cashing in.
I'd be surprised if even if anybody offered, say, 70 million for him, I think at his best he is phenomenal, absolutely unplayable. He's brilliant to watch. He's just extraordinary. But he does have quite a few off days. And I think it's just a few too many off days for teams to commit so much money for him, I think. I mean, it's been said before, he does get a bit rattled by... I mean, he's quite rightly gets annoyed when he gets hacked down and he doesn't get free kick or the opposing player doesn't get booked or whatever. But he does seem to sort of ruffle him a bit and he just doesn't get up and carry on as normal. So, yes, it is a tricky one. He may end up staying or Palace will have to reduce their valuation by a huge amount.
It was another exhilarating midweek of football with two dramatic championship playoff semi-final second legs. And when all was said and done, it will be Derby County and Aston Villa fighting it out at Wembley a week on Monday for a place in the Premier League. Derby had lost all three of their previous meetings with Leeds this season, but they won the game that mattered most, 4-2 at Elland Road. Ollie, Frank Lampard's first season in management will end then at Wembley. What a story he is writing right now.
Yeah, I think whichever teams had got through, I mean, there would have been a great story because it's been sort of four fascinating plot lines of those teams who have been in the playoffs. But Lampard's first season has been fantastic, really. I mean, I praised him last night on Twitter after the game and the impact he's made. And somebody said to me, well, if you look, you know, they were sixth last season under Gary Rowett, sixth now. Is it really any different? You know, they're generally in the playoffs. Is it really any different? And I would say, yes, it's markedly different because if you look at the way they've played, well, no, just look at the squad they've got. They've moved out a lot of experienced players last summer, which was all about bringing them down the wage bill, which was part of the mandate from the owner, Mel Morris. He wanted a tighter, younger squad. He wanted them to, you know, take a different approach in the transfer market, looking to, you know, players like Marriott at Peterborough and using the loan market and getting people like Wilson and Mount in from Liverpool and Chelsea, respectively. And he's integrated all of these younger players into a team, which he said from the start, I mean, I went to see him in the build-up to his first game against Reading back in August. He said that, you know, we want to play a different way. We want to play more expansively than the club's played before. And they've done that. And they've made a big leap in terms of playing style, the evolution of the squad. There's a lot of younger players, a couple of older heads too, like Keo. But I think he's done really well in terms of that. I think there were a lot of questions asked about whether he'd been rattled by the whole Spygate thing and whether, you know, he was yet another manager who was unable to sort of get Derby through their traditional February-March yips, which they seem to have year after year. But he's got them to end the season strongly. They showed real character and quality and bravery, I would say, in that playoff last night. I think everybody in the media was, you know, it was quite into the sort of Leeds story, the idea of Leeds finally getting up again. But I'm just really pleased for people at Derby who I know, and Lampard in particular, I think has done a really good job.
And they've, as you say, they've finished sixth this season as they did last season. But in the big games, they've really impressed. So obviously, after the league season's finished, they've had that great comeback to beat Leeds, and then in the cups, they matched Manchester United at Old Trafford and won on penalties. They matched Southampton over two games in the FA Cup and won that on penalties. And the style of play is very impressive, and it does. You know, you have to say he's done well in his first season. And interesting that Stephen Gerrard has taken Rangers on this season, third up to second, and Sol Campbell's done very well, turned Macclesfield.
Paul Scholes has done wonders at all.
That's the one exception, but he only had seven games, so it's not really enough for enough of a sample. But those three, you can see imagine a trend where any former England player coming up for a, you know, making themselves available will be sought after.
Ollie, you said that some people thought Frank Lampard might have been rattled by Spygate. Obviously, his he was obviously surprised. And I think in his initial reaction, he said a few things that I disagreed with, and he might, with hindsight, disagree with too. But how do you think, when we've seen a guy like Frank Lampard is so public, like even people who don't like him, that dude never really got rattled even as a player. I mean, if there's one guy you would think does actually not get rattled or hasn't gotten rattled since a long, long time, since Ayanapa perhaps, I mean, it's Frank Lampard, right?
Yeah. I would agree with you, but there was this, Leeds fans singing the, stop crying Frank Lampard song the other day.
You can't get into that guy's head. It's kind of like, it's like if he was in a wheelchair and was bald, he'd be Professor Xavier. Like, you can't, there's other ways to beat Frank Lampard, but you're not going to go and mess with his mind.
No, exactly. I think, had they not turned it right last night, I think a lot of people would have said, oh, Leeds got under your skin, Leeds did this. And I don't think they did. I think if you look at the interview he gave straight after the game, and even the celebrations, you could tell he was utterly pumped up, but pumped up in a positive way. He wasn't, I don't think he would have flown off the handle if they'd lost. I think he was entitled to enjoy those celebrations as much as he did. He said, that it did mean an awful lot to him. For him personally, it's a massive achievement to get them to the playoffs in his first season. But yeah, I think people can very easily form a wrong, incorrect opinion about what players are like. And we, in our job, we're privileged to get some access and exposure to some of these people, and you learn more about them as people. And I've always said to people, whenever people ask me what certain footballers are like, Frank Lampard is one that I always tell people is just intelligent, bright, warm, nice, sensitive guy. He's very, very impressive. I felt that he had all the sort of tools to be a good manager, but you just wonder sometimes whether somebody will get the opportunity to show that. And Derby have been a club who have been sort of had a Watford-like turnover of managers in the last sort of 5 or 6 years or so. So he's had to do well just to retain the owner's faith throughout the season.
Not many would have given Derby a chance at Elland Road, but it has ended up with heartbreak for Leeds, Bill. And when you look at their form over the last 6 weeks, they really did squander their chance of promotion.
Yeah, they did. Yeah. I mean, overall, they were 13th last season, so they've taken a huge step up. So, and as long as if Bielsa stays, then they can look forward with optimism for next season. Otherwise, it's all kind of back to square one again. But they'll look. The Leeds fans will be haunted by the Good Friday match against Wigan, when they went into it 3 points ahead of Sheffield United. They were 1-0 up very early on. Wigan had a player sent off, but Wigan, who were fighting against relegation, lost 75 minutes, had 10 men, but managed to win the game. And they did. Leeds just didn't recover from that. They did kind of, I guess there's a certain amount of kind of hysteria about Leeds this season, because, which is understandable among their fans, because it's so long, 15 years since they were in the Premier League, and for such a big club. They'd won the league in the previous 15 years, they'd got the Champions League semi-final, and so to fall away like that, and they've not really got close to, since the 2006 playoff final, they've not got close to coming back, and they dropped down to League One. So suddenly they've thrust up into the automatic promotion positions, and it perhaps got a bit too much for them in the end.
They're going to pay your old mate in Wembley.
I know, this is
and
it.
Actually, no, I want to ask you a question about this.
Oh, gosh.
Because already it was happening on Twitter, and I want to ask you, and I want to hear from my way, are we going to get 2 weeks of this Lamps versus JT narrative? So I just want to reiterate, John Terry is not the Aston Villa manager. Mm-hmm. He's not the Aston Villa assistant manager, because that would be Mr. O'Kelly, Richard O'Kelly,
Richard
who we've
O'Kelly.
Talked about at length. He's at best the assistant to the assistant to the regional manager. He's a guy who stands out. He happens to be more famous than all these people, but he's only worked there since Steve Bruce left. I'm not dissing him, but you can't put him. It's not JT versus Frank Lampard Jr. And I want to ask you to keep flying the flag for Dean Smith, because Dean Smith is the Aston Villa manager, correct?
Absolutely. And I will be flying the flag for Dean Smith because he's done a terrific job at Aston Villa. I mean, to have got them into the playoffs in such a strong way, they finished the season so strongly, you definitely have to fly the flag for Dean Smith, for Richard O'Kelly, and John Terry's a little side thing. That's how I look at it.
Ollie, are you on board on this? Because you will be asked to write those wonderful, like, sort of features and the characters and blah, blah, blah. Will you join us in the battle to recognize the work of Dean Smith and Richard O'Kelly?
I was having a chat with the desk this morning about ideas ahead of the playoff final and the big JT versus Lamps head to head showdown was not part of it. I don't think there's any undue focus on John Terry in our plans. Although I do find his role and his prominence interesting. I think it's going to be a really good game. I'm immediately looking forward to that, and it's, you know, he's part of that because they're big clubs and big names and big personalities. Well, yeah, probably, but I think the way they've been playing in the final weeks of the season makes you think it's going to be a good game, and Jack Grealish is somebody who will always catch the eye as well. So it's, I would say there's going to be a lot of good young English talent on display, including some of the loanees that I mentioned earlier.
Tammy Abraham versus Fikayo Tomori.
Yeah.
That's a better shout, right? Mason Mount versus Jack Grealish. You've got all these little Anglo subplots that you guys love so much because they involve young players, right?
Yeah, exactly. And, well, we can't take for granted that we see young homegrown talent when we go to Premier League matches. So this, in what is frequently and nauseatingly sort of described as the most valuable, expensive game in world football, I think it's nice that both teams will be showing their trust in homegrown talent.
And regardless of the result at Wembley, what we can say for certain is that the Premier League will be welcoming another up-and-coming English manager. Obviously, Chris Wilder will be there with Sheffield United, but Dean Smith or Frank Lampard will be in the Premier League, Bill.
Yes, that's usually the way English managers get into the Premier League, by being promoted.
That's a really good point, one we've made before, and Premier League clubs just simply don't scout the Championship at all, do they?
No.
Unless you're David Moyes, maybe he's not the last guy, or Paul Ince, but they're like...
Mm. Oh, it's extremely, I remember looking into
it. It's so weird, it's so different. It's another one of those things that makes y'all different from the rest of humanity when it comes to football. Mm.
Just enough time to give you the answer to Bill Edgar's trivia teaser. We asked last weekend which team became the first for 14 years to receive less than one yellow card per game over a Premier League season. We came up with a few, but it was just randomness from us, really.
Well, they had 37 yellow cards in the 38 games. And the team was Liverpool.
Oh,
interestingly.
Oh.
Liverpool. So you might think, oh, it's obviously successful teams then. But no, the last team to go under a yellow card per game in the Premier League, 2004-05, Norwich, when they were relegated. So, you know,
Bournemouth do.
It varies. But Bournemouth have had a good disciplinary record.
Who are the really bad guys?
Well, Watford have had the most yellows this year, I know.
Most of them Troy Deeney, I assume.
Yeah. And Holibas into double figures, I think. Says Liverpool. Fabinho was booked 6 times. That's the most.
Is part of your theory being that Liverpool get such good treatment from referees because of the vast pro-Liverpool media conspiracy in the punditocracy that we've been hearing so much about that, and that Pep Guardiola himself alluded to?
Yeah, I don't think all Liverpool yellow cards get reported. I think you put the goals in, and then opposition yellow cards can get reported, but gotcha. Not all of them. Yeah.
There you go. Okay, that is it for now. Many thanks to our guests today, Ollie Kay and Bill Edgar.
Remember, you can subscribe to The Times and The Sunday Times to enjoy award-winning journalism online and on your smartphone or tablet. Just £1 a week for an 8-week trial. Search The Times subscription for more information.
We'll be back on Monday when Watford will have secured their first major trophy, or Manchester City will be treble winners.
The Game is brought to you by The Times. For more information and more podcasts from The Times, head to thetimes.co.uk.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on. Settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books. Contacts. Calendar. Double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.